First reading this morning comes from Jacob's circular letter, otherwise known as the Epistle or the Letter of James. It's found in the New Testament. Martin Luther hated this book and wanted to rip it out of the Bible, if for no other reason that it completely refuted his central message. It claims, we're not sure when it was written, within 30 years or so, and it claims to have been written by someone named Jacob, or James in English, and I've never understood how the word James comes from Jacob, because the consonants are different. No one's been able to explain that to me. We don't think it was written to any particular city or community. We think it was a circular letter that was passed around to urban Jewish communities, which were all over the Roman Empire. And remember that the people that we often now call the early Christians thought of themselves as Jews. The word Christian wasn't used for 100 years after Jesus died. And the word synagogue is in this letter. The ancient Christians used the word synagogue and ecclesia interchangeably. They both meant meeting place or place of gathering. So all the differences that we see now developed. They weren't there at the beginning at all. This is my own translation of the letter from the Greek.
My dear family, take note, all of you. Please, listen to others first. Speak to others second. Express your anger to others last. For your anger of itself does not bring about God's justice. So dig out the stuff that's spoiling inside you and toss out the compost seething there, and instead spread it in the garden inside you where reason has been planted, the reason which can make you whole. It makes no sense to listen to reason, however, if you don't put it into practice. Anyone who listens to reason but doesn't practice it reminds me of when I look into a mirror, recognize myself, and then walk away and forget what I look like. But if you pay attention to the Torah, the law that liberates us, and then put that liberation into practice, you will not forget what it says, and you will find happiness in the practice. If you claim the word spiritual for yourself, but keep blathering all the time, you're fooling yourself and your so-called spirituality doesn't mean anything. Spirituality that originates with God, our true parent, is more like this: to take care of the needs of destitute widows and orphans, and to keep yourself unsnared by the dominant system. Oh, my family, don't play favorites. Let's imagine someone coming into your synagogue dressed to the nines, jewelry, fashionable apparel. And at the same time, someone comes into the meeting wearing worn, even tattered clothes. If you pay special attention to the first, saying, "Here's a good seat for you, right up front," but say to the second, "Hey, you, go stand over there," or even, "Sit down on the floor near me so I can keep an eye on you," have you not clearly made a judgment as to who belongs and who doesn't? Listen, you seem to be confused. The poor are rich in faithfulness and even exemplify God-given citizenship in the realm of justice and honesty we are trying to establish. But isn't it often the folks who have it all, who are the people slandering your noble name, exploiting you and dragging you into court all the time? If you really were paying attention to our excellent Torah, where it is written, "You shall love your neighbor as you love yourself," that's when you're really well off. But when you show favoritism, you err and trample on the Torah, which will then trample on your conscience, make sure that you act as if you really believe that the Torah sets you free. For when you don't show compassion to others, you can't expect any yourself. Isn't compassion for all always better than dividing us into the haves and have-nots?
The second reading is from the poet Marge Piercy, who, like me, and an amazing number of other people in this particular congregation, grew up in the city of Detroit, once called Detroit the Beautiful, now one of the saddest cities in the United States of America for a number of reasons. It's called Motown, Arsenal of Democracy, and it dates to the year 2006. And I decided to read this myself. It's a hard poem. It's about my hometown. Fog used to blossom off the distant river, turning our streets strange, elongating sounds and muffling others. The crack of a gunshot softened. The sky at night was a dull red, a bonfire built of old creosote, soaked logs by the railroad tracks. A red, almost pink, painted by factories that never stopped their roar, like traffic in the canyons of New York. But stop they did, and fell down, ending those dangerous jobs that actually paid. We believed in our unions, like some trust in their priests. We believed in Friday paychecks, sure as winter's ice curb to curb, where older boys could play hockey dodging cars, wooden pucks, sticks cracking wood on wood. A man came home with a new car, and other men would collect around it like ants in sugar. Women clumping for showers, wedding and baby, wakes, funerals, care for the man brought home with a hole ripped in him. Children coughing. We all coughed in Detroit. We woke at dawn to my father's hack. That world is gone, like a tableau of old wagon trains, expressways carved neighborhoods to shreds. Rich men moved jobs south, then overseas. Only the old anger lives there, bubbling up like chemicals dumped, seething now into the water, building now into the bones. The unbelievable events in Japan more than 2 weeks ago have captured the imagination and kindled the horror and the grief of the entire world. Cosma Albert, the Unitarian minister at our own congregation's partner church over in Berlin, Romania, actually sent me a letter this week about how it has affected their hearts all the way over there, these people in our partner church who have themselves suffered nothing but terrible flooding this winter, a very, very awful, icy part of winter as well, and which have struggled for months with bureaucratic nightmares out of Bucharest concerning the use of one of their buildings that it would have made me throw in the towel a long time ago. But they're concerned and affected by what happened in Japan. Yet, as we all know, other events are also claiming our hearts and our minds, at least some of us. They have been briefly eclipsed by the disaster in Japan, but they're still vibrant. In several states in our union, including our own state of Ohio, as well as Wisconsin and Michigan and some others, we read of unprecedented demonstrations, mostly at the state houses. In Wisconsin, these are especially big, with upwards of 75,000 people gathered to confront and rail against the power plays disguised as policy. I was at our own state house one day when the paper estimated the crowd there to be over 5,000, nothing to sneeze at on a Tuesday afternoon at 1 o'clock, a work day. People are demonstrating about many things, to be sure, but the right to negotiate via unions, the right to have a voice in one's own livelihood, is certainly central. We believed in our unions like some trust in their priests. We believed in those Friday paychecks, sure as winter's ice, curb to curb. Of all the lines in Marge Piercy's difficult poem about Detroit, my hometown, that's the one that stands up for me. Oh, I heard the gunshots. I saw the red sunsets. I saw people playing hockey in the streets, dodging cars. My mother went to all the baby showers and wedding showers, all that too. But the line about the unions really stood out for me. After all, I didn't grow up surrounded by golf green lawns and white picket fences. I grew up with crabgrass lawns and stories of picket lines. I grew up with the sure knowledge that paychecks were reliable on Friday because of the voice of the unions at times past. My father grew up working in auto factories. I worked in them too in the summers to put myself through school, hardest work I've ever done. But my father worked in those factories before the unions, as did my grandfather, who was one of the folks who actually worked to get the union into Ford. And from him, I heard tell many tales of strikes and pickets. I learned new vocabulary words as a child. I learned that a scab was not just a boo-boo on my kneecap. My father remembered the 12-hour days and what Piercy calls the dangerous working conditions at the great Ford Rouge plant, employing 52,000 people. It's bigger than most towns in America. But he also told us about what kind of nonsense he experienced before the unions came into the factory. His immediate boss, for example, had no use for Catholics and no use for the children of immigrants with lots of vowels in their last names. seeing in the opening of my father's shirt that he wore a scapular around his neck. A scapular is a little cloth talisman dedicated to a saint. His supervisor used to routinely mock him. Stupid mackerel snapper Dago. My father, of course, had no one to go to. This was his boss. And he had to put up with it, which was no easy task for him, since his temper was quick and ferocious all of my life. Until one day, the bossman actually reached in past his shirt, past the collar with his hand, and lifted out the scapular, and then ridiculed my father for holding it in his hand. My father was terrified. This was his boss. But he was being ridiculed, and the gift his mother had given him was being ridiculed. So my father got out of the way of his own anger, made a fist, cursed the fool out, and was immediately fired, of course. He fumed about that event for many years. We heard the replay over and over again at the supper table. This wouldn't have been allowed had the union been there, he said. Yet when he was older and a supervisor himself at the power company, he changed his mind about unions. He insisted that they had lost their focus. But even so, he never stopped telling the story of how terrified he was by his bigot boss. And there was nothing that he could do about it and still keep his job. Now listen, this month I've been talking about diversity and difference. That's the theme of the month. And when I lift up the word diversity as I have, I am clearly lifting up a vision of all different kinds of people, different in culture, different in religion, different in way of life or sexuality and so forth, learning to work and live and worship together, side by side, forming a pluralistic community. But sadly, there are diversities that also exist, differences which are between us and this world, which can actually paralyze us with fear, make us feel threatened. We may get so scared that we can't even imagine trying to live side by side with those whose difference from us is not one of gender or color or culture, but one of brutal power. I know a woman up in Detroit who voted for the governor there, the governor who, like so many these days, has abolished collective bargaining rights. This woman, who is herself a union steward, has been told that she can just expect to get a 15% cut in her pay and that she'll have to pay a large share of her health insurance from now on, and that if she's going to complain about it, she can just go find another job. Which in Michigan, I assure you, is a completely laughable idea. This is brutal power. This is a threat, plain and simple. Do what we say, or you're toast. This is an unhappy situation. It prompts my own fear for the nation, and fear for the state, and fear for the future, which I share with all of you. This is not a live and let live diversity. This is not you marry whom you want to marry and I'll marry who I want to marry. You choose your flavor of Jenny's ice cream, I'll choose my flavor of Jenny's ice cream. This is something else. This is, I am different from you and you are different from me. Our diversity boils down to this. I have power, you have none. At least that's what I'm trying to convince you. And I will run you over if you don't go along with what I propose. So start shaking in your boots, curtsy nicely, and kowtow. Just kowtow. This is a diversity unlike the diversity spoken of in our mission statement that is not our strength, not our joy. This is not the path to excellence and gratitude. This is a difference of power that simply paralyzes with fear. It involves the threat of and actual loss of jobs and livelihood, the diminishment of aid for those who cannot survive without it, and a trivialization of the educational opportunities for our children. This is a diversity that threatens to make much of what we have known for decades disappear, just like one of those old tableaux of wagon trains, which we see no longer anymore either, to quote Marge Piercy's poem. Now, when I talk about being afraid of differences in power, I want to be clear, I'm not talking about what happened in the story this morning, okay? I want to be clear about that. There, a truly homely large fish is isolated because smaller, sleeker fish are afraid of him. His size and his shape are perceived as frightening. He's not using his size to bully. He's not using his size to brutalize. There's no policy here, no philosophy, no agenda. It's just a big, homely, lonely fish, rudely isolated by those who want others in their life to look comfortably like them. The story is saying, I might be put off at first by differences, a different way of dressing, a different look, maybe some ethnic headscarf, maybe some technicolor tattoo. I may be put off at first by either a cultural shyness or a cultural flamboyance, but none of these differences display an absolute disparity of power, do they? They may briefly surprise us, they may briefly shock us, but they do not frighten at a visceral level. And I can learn to live with them and actually really come to appreciate them, even piercings. But the demonstrations in and around several Midwest state houses tell me that we're talking about much deeper fears, not a surprise uniqueness that I'll simply learn to like over time. Like the demonstrations blossoming all over North Africa and the Middle East, these demonstrations not only express fear, but real and indeed growing anger. Which brings me to the insightful letter of James. The author is very clear, about the basics of good religion, spirituality. Care for the destitute, widows, and orphans first. Love your neighbor as you love yourself. Your gatherings, your synagogue, your church, can be as pluralistic as you'd like, as diverse as you'd like. Women and men, the sick and the healthy, the marginalized and the successful, every nationality and color and economic status, every personality type, differing ability and look. But the widows and orphans always, always, always come first. Those who are oppressed, those who are pushed to the edge, those who are stolen from by the system. The widows and orphans always come first. The love of neighbor, always comes first. That's basic, James says. I happen to agree. The author then comments on anger as a response to life's issues. His clear advice, show your anger last. Listen first, the author says. Speak second. Then, if need be, when you have all the facts, show your anger. After all, anger without all the facts, without thoughtfulness in its expression, doesn't actually accomplish anything, does it? And we are here for accomplishment of some sort, are we not? Accomplished loving, accomplished caring for those pushed over the edge of care by the dominant system. It's my translation for the word cosmos in the Greek, usually translated as world, but that makes it sound as if the world of materiality, the material world, is somehow bad, like some Greek philosophy said, which is most certainly not true. Most knowledgeable translators outside traditional theological models no longer translate it as world, but more as I have, as the dominant system. So the author tells us that our best spiritual practice, after providing for the widows and orphans, is to keep ourselves unsnared by the dominant system. Those unfeeling systems that put profit before people, greed before grace, privilege before purpose. The dominant systems, in fact, are easily recognizable. They are recognizable because they completely turn James's advice upside down. They begin with anger, anger that people express needs, anger that people want equality, anger that anyone would disagree with them, anger that sharing is required by any understanding of justice. And then they proceed to speak, but only to tell us to lose our voice or else. Finally, they get to the listening stage. But since the powers that be tell us that they are revving up their bus to run us over, it will be hard to hear us anyway, won't it? Buses can be very noisy, you know. But James doesn't let anyone off the hook. He doesn't allow anyone to feel self-righteous. Even though we may be fearful at times and angry, he asks us to examine our own attitudes toward diversity and class. Do you yourselves divide people into the haves and have-nots by how you welcome people into your life? Maybe you should work on that issue yourself, too, while you're working on these other issues, while you're preparing to engage with those who frighten you. Ask yourself about other things that frighten you and how you live your life in response to those. But the engagement has to be there. Real engagement, not staged debates between parties or between religions. Those are rarely helpful in my experience. It's just the converted shouting at the converted. Big deal. What a waste of time. No, engagement has to be personal, varied. There's no one simple answer, sorry. And passionately rational. The word logos in the letter of James is very often translated as word, but in most Greek philosophy, it's translated as reason, and that's how I translated it. Rational, reasonable. The demonstrations, yes, plenty of them, but also personal phone calls to those leaders who will take the time to listen, and they actually pay attention to those things. It means taking time, as rare a commodity as that is, to write real letters. Bring up real questions crafted with our best reason, to tell our best stories, and stories that are supported also by our research. The Bread organization that our congregation is part of has this down real good, I think. You always do the research. You read about it. You don't just respond and react without thinking. You actually take the time. And I'm sorry that it takes so much time, but it does. I'm sorry. The questions we raise in this fearful time, both as individuals and as people joining together in a larger voice, always need to be forged out of the ancient principle that James lifts up from the Torah. You shall love your neighbor as you love yourself. That's basic, and it remains basic, no matter how angry or how afraid we may feel. If that's tossed out, then my worry doubles. It's possible, I say, for us to get back to a diversity that strengthens us, not weakens us, one that energizes us rather than makes us afraid or angry. To do that means we will have to not let the anger and fear live in our bones, as Marge Piercy says it does in The Despairing Citizenship of Detroit, now stripped of both their unions and their formerly thriving industries. It does mean transforming our fears into anger, but not leading with the anger, as the self-anointed do and the self-righteous do. It means transforming that anger into well-thought-out reason, carefully wrought plans, creative responses, self-awareness, mindfulness, organization, anything in short, that is not some new form of hand-wringing despair. That doesn't do anything. Many unions may need some reform. Okay, let's talk about that. Every human institution needs reform. That seems sensible enough to say. But these collectives to voice common concerns were not founded on despair, but on faith that it might actually be possible, in James's words, to live in the realm of justice and honesty together and to build that realm ourselves. We may have no power to stop earthquakes in Japan or flooding in Romania, but we do have the power to work together to transform the differences in our modern world so that they are not a source of fear, not a source of fear any longer, but our clearest invitation to optimistic, patient, uncomplaining, and effective justice work.